This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Pamela Murray Winters is here. She is one of the most original voices I know. We love her work, and we want her to give us a poem. Pam.
Okay, thank you, Grace. Hoisting the Pretend Sail. Later, I learned my favorite home was away. My favorite songs came in tabletop jukeboxes in bus stations en route to the tombs of unknown cousins. My favorite candies were the ones you broke with a hammer or both your hands. Bark, brittle, sugar rock, the necklace that rained the rainbow O's with the snap of a cord. They'd dent your palms, draw blood in the mouth, and later raise welts on the tender buds. Drunk on Dad's root beer and being 5 1/2, I'd collage a life from the rings and swords that fell from the gumball slot. Not for me, the chewy cherry cigar, the white powder smokes. I wanted handfuls, foreign cargo, salvaged moments on my tongue. And not for me, the life you earn, but the one you collect, bits, bins, barnacles. But that was away. When my mind was loose as the sea, as young as the sea was old, when I could say, I'm a princess, a pirate, a tabby cat, and make it so. Adulthood, this is the worst trip.
Pamela Winters, what does that poem say about you?
I think of myself as a child as having a sort of, I want to say greed. Greed is too harsh a word, especially
That's
for a child.
A terrible word.
I wanted things, and I see that in this poem, the candy and.
But they're all sensual things.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a big part of your poetry, I think. And as a child, you were actually a little imitation of what you are now, because I find that there's a great deal of sensuality, taste, smells, vision in your poems. So now we know what you came from. Mm-hmm. And this is the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. You were a music critic.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, writing about music, watching music, even a book about music. So how does that collide with your writing? How does that show up? How do we know about that in you from your poetry?
From my poetry. There are obvious ways. I certainly gained a reputation with my previous teacher, Stanley Plumlee, would refer to me as, you know, the rock and roll poet or whatever, because I write a lot about, specifically about musicians and performers. But
Is the beat in your poetry, do you think? Or do you think more it's a subject for your poetry?
I hear a music in my poetry, and usually a lot of my poems just start with my hearing a line in my head. It's usually as I'm falling asleep, of course, so I probably sleep through a lot of potential poems. But yeah, there's sound. I was telling a friend yesterday, I'm also a copy editor and proofreader, so I spell really well, read really well, but I'm not a very visual person. I think I probably experience the world a lot more through sound and certainly the other senses.
I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. Let's hear a poem.
Okay. This is a poem. It's a fairly new poem, not published yet. It's called Scarlet. It's a word I loved. Was its etymology little scar? Miss Scarlet in Clue preened on her card for our delectation. Scarlett O'Hara was a heroine, though not mine. I knew Melanie was a better person. But it's Scarlett's story. How we kept our skirts over our knees, prayed to be Melanie or Beth from Little Women. We all find, eventually, that virtue isn't viable. Scarlett, a swath of red through snow. What is that life force, soul or blood? Life on the tongue, in the lips, is red. The body is the shade of the sconce of the bloodlight. The girl in the ballad wore a scarlet ribbon around her neck. When her suitor slipped it from her skin, off came her head.
You know, you lure us into the beauty of that poem, and then you really whack it at the end, right? please take us through your thinking, your associations. I would just love to know what goes on in you. So tell us about what a poet does from one word to the other. How scar becomes scarlet. How scarlet becomes blood in the snow. Just talk about that. Is it possible to talk about that?
It's difficult to talk about that, isn't it?
It's a mystery.
I mean, especially if you've been doing it for a long time. It just kind of gets into you. And I think differently from a lot of people. And
No, I think poets all do this.
Well, yeah,
poets
certainly.
They leap from word to word, mm-hmm. and one suggests another word. But this is more of a surreality than I ever see in your work.
Mm-hmm.
This is more surreal, more the nighttime mind, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I often write poems that are based on, or the springing off point, the triggering town, is a single word. And I'll think about what that word means to me. And when I hear scarlet, it's almost a synesthesia. There's a kind of sharpness to it. There's a sort of cutting. And then I get to the literal, the punning almost of scar and scarlet.
Now people know what a poet is. Mm. This is literally demonstrating what a poet is. That better than anyone could describe it. Because you're showing, you're demonstrating what the brain does, which prose writers do not do. Other writers do not do. So it's a species. Mm-hmm. It's a breed.
I never write, or I seldom write about something. There's usually a jumping off point. Or sometimes I don't know what I'm writing about until I'm nearly done.
They recommend that.
Yeah.
They recommend that. However, it's the hardest way to discover yourself. Give us another.
I'm going to read one out of my book.
Yes, we want to talk about your book. It is
The Unbeckonable Bird.
We're going to read from The Unbeckonable Bird by Pamela Murray Winters. What is this book about?
It's about as much as my poems are usually about.
Words.
You know, it is about me. I realized when I'd written it when I'd finished it, that I had a sense of it as kind of a microcosm of who I am or who I was last summer. Because, you know, when you publish something, after a while it starts to seem a little stale, or you think, oh, I wish I hadn't put that poem in, or, you know, other things. I guess there's always an evolution of sorts.
But it has to be about you,
mm-hmm.
or then it's not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply that. If it doesn't come from the soul, I mean, it's not the truth. So I believe this is an autobiography. Let's hear a bit of it.
It kind of is, isn't it? There are threads in here about music and about exploring things, about my emotions. This is kind of a strange one. The poem isn't strange, but it's kind of strange that I wrote a poem about this. It's called On Seeing the Word Ether in Lorna Luft's Memoir. I wasn't scared. I was warned about the mask and that I would go to sleep. What I can't remember is the smell. Maybe like shiny gowns, the sort of freezers defrosted with picks and cake pans, empty tubes of lipstick. They don't use it now, too volatile. In her memoir, Lorna Luft said her mother was never a drunk. It was all pills, and people used to think they were safe. The spin doctors, the drugs we don't talk about, the exhaustion, the out of control, the cuts and tucks, the innumerable tiny explosions on elevators. Too often, we lie about what makes a star. Or we do what seems best at the time, what the experts choose. In London, Judy called the Queen's doctor for her daughter's sickness, who said there was nothing wrong. It was Lenny Bruce's doctor who found the girl's appendix about to burst, saving Lorna's life. A commoner, I was unscathed by my ether. Too young to know the crapshoot of history. Maybe we lose our tonsils. Maybe the hospital burns.
Boy, you really like to give it to us on that last line, don't you? What happens to you? You just churn up some energy, and then when you get to that last line, whack, you give it to us. So what were you doing reading her memoir? And first of all, tell the audience who Lorna Luft was. So what's her name?
Lorna Luft was the less famous of Judy Garland's daughters. I hope I don't have to explain who Judy Garland is, but that seems to be the way it happens with my poems. I'm quite often having to explain who this or that person was. Anyway, Lorna Luft is also in the music business, but not to the extent of Liza.
Is that why you read her memoir?
I don't remember. I came across it somewhere.
Did you take her idea? Was she talking about anesthesia?
Yeah, she was talking about her getting sick when she was over in England with her mother, who was touring, and how no one could figure out what was wrong, and it was Lenny Bruce's doctor who discovered that she had appendicitis.
Now, who was Lenny Bruce?
Lenny Bruce, a famous comedian. These people were all before my time, Grace.
Oh, listen, I know who they were.
I have an old soul.
But remember, this is a new generation out there. It's a sad thing that they don't know who Lenny Bruce is.
Well,
but he's immortal now in your poem.
He's a character in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, so you will see him on television. But
Pamela Murray Winters is here. She's inimitable. She connects words. She starts with words. She ends up with words. She's got a punch at the end, and we're going to go on with her poetry. You studied with Stanley Plumlee.
I did.
He is one of the great icons of American literature. I believe he's the foremost Keats scholar, and probably Keats incarnated, I believe. Don't you think? His writing is so beautiful. So you studied, he was your mentor for a long time. What did you bring away from that? He has now passed. What did you learn? If you could just summarize it.
He had this group of us, most of whom were over 50 at the time we studied with him, for 10 years or more. And I think he saw that a lot of us had ways that we were going with poetry that we'd been doing for quite a while, and he would often take us back to the basics. He supported a lot of poets whose aesthetics were very different from his, and so...
He's much loved.
I really...
Much loved.
He was a wonderful man.
And look, you stuck with him for 10 years, so it had to be good.
I studied with him at the Writers' Center in D.C., and... Then it kind of spun off from that to where we were having classes in other places, like up near his home in Frederick, Maryland, and also in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. He taught at the Sotto Voce Poetry Conference. Mm. And so this poem, another new poem, was written after a trip to that conference. A bunch of us poets rented an Airbnb for the weekend and were up there cooking and hanging out. And I wrote this poem for my friend Martin Shapiro, a really fine poet, should be better known. It's called Between Barefoot and Vinaigrette. In what God's world is beauty forced upon you? People don't know any better, so you're made to go, even though you've seen uncountable rainbows. And this one will be different only because you're in West Virginia with poets, a species thought to care about rainbows. Your species... So why don't you care? What kind of tenderfoot poet are you, wanting to stay at the kitchen table and drizzle vinaigrette over fresh-cut tomatoes and artfully crumpled basil leaves? What kind of depressive, what kind of lazy bones, what kind of human doesn't care about the sky? So you creep over the hot gravel, then walk on the asphalt, then jog a little to the top of the hill. Yeah, a rainbow. But look at the poets. That's your beauty.
That's terrific. I was saying to someone today about that poem, real writers really want to just stay home and write. I mean, we love the elements at times, but it's so typical to just not even want to venture out when you're working on a poem, but to love the other poets. That's a terrific poem. And I do think we feel that way. Mm-hmm. We feel just better than we were by being with another poet.
A lot of us who studied with Stanley Plumlee are still meeting with each other and going over our poems. We've been doing this for a while now.
Why stop now?
Developed quite a community, so he's still teaching us in that way.
That is superb. What a legacy that he goes on. Well, that's quite a thing to say. Yeah, you have one poem that I'm crazy about, and it's about Leonard Cohen, I'm crazy about. You actually got to see him in person?
Yeah, I saw him in concert on what was supposedly his farewell tour, which I think was about three farewell tours ago.
He's, of course, now definitely farewelled.
But you said this was 2009.
2009, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was in Maryland?
Mm-hmm. The famous Meriwether Post Pavilion, big venue.
I wanted to talk about this poem after you read it because it goes everywhere.
Yeah.
And I love the way that you're just always one strike away from reality.
I was no longer a music critic when I wrote this poem. I wasn't doing that in any frequent way, just now and again, but it reflects the way I approached music as a writer about music. And it's called The Essential Man. Leonard Cohen, Columbia, Maryland, May 13th, 2009. Sent aside in some rental truck, purple and silver gold drapes like streamers for a prom in Baltimore or hell, and a Persian rug to prey on, and battlements and wires we needn't see, because everybody knows it's the man who makes things move. He generates the Elvis leg. He does the Toronto tarantella. He flaunts the pizzicato beret. He flanks the showbud pedal steel. He cradles kindness and the microphone in palms gentle as an old lover's breath. He instigates two blonde cartwheels quick and gone. He testifies to the rose that lies 14 inches ahead of his toe. His knee balances the sky. He is an orchestra of left hands, pressing keys, clasping chords, beckoning to follow, collecting what falls for an instant, then letting it fall. He is down to essence, the servants beside and before, the nails on his fingers and toes, the song that swells him to sail us over the festoons, through the northern territories, straight off the map.
I feel that I know him so much more by that poem, and I just want to go through some of these things. Elvis leg? Did he shake his leg?
He did shake his leg. He had that mm-hmm. posture with that sort of, yeah.
But the knee. Really? His pelvis out?
No, really, it was just the leg.
Okay.
I think the pelvis was still Leonard's, but the leg was Elvis's.
But did he really do two cartwheels, or was that metaphoric?
He did not. His background singers, he had a pair of twin blonde background singers, and at one point during the concert, they just did these cartwheels on stage. It was the kind of situation where you felt like anything could happen.
And his knee was balancing the sky. Did he lift his knee up?
I don't remember. I think I was just looking at, he may have been kneeling at that point.
His nails on his hands and toes? What was that about?
I thought that, yes, he is down to essence. The nails on his fingers and toes. He was pretty old at this point. He was talking about how this might be, he'd probably never see us again. I was somewhat taken aback when he was there the next summer. you showman, you.
Good PR.
But
in essence, we get, I think the things you say that are so actual are the way he cradled the mic with tenderness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can see that about him, how he is essence himself. What did he sing that you loved? Did he sing Hallelujah?
I think he sang Hallelujah.
He better.
I think he's contractually obligated to sing Hallelujah. I don't remember. I'm hearing
Lucky
Everybody
you,
Knows in my head as I read this. That's what I'm remembering.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a great poem. Has it been published?
It's in my book, yeah.
Oh, and isn't this the one in response to the Beach Boys, or is that another one?
No, that was the first one that I read.
I forgot to tell us that.
Yeah. It was inspired. I had to write a poem that was inspired by a Beach Boys song. Mm-hmm. I always liked Sloop John B. This is going back to Hoisting the Pretend Sail. I liked that song as a child, and it brought back to me these memories of being a small child and of small child things in the early 60s. You know, the fascination with those tabletop jukeboxes in bus stations and.
Well, let's go on with another poem. This is Pamela Murray Winters, and she has an unforgettable voice. It is just so fresh that I don't think any amount of scholarly tutorials could take away what you are, which is surprising. And it's the best thing a poet could be.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is to be you, right?
I think so.
That winds up, I mean, we've tried everyone else. Yes. So let's hear another poem.
I don't know if you want me to tell you about, we can talk about it afterwards. It's called The Limits of Culture. A 30-year-old man was brought to us from the field hospital 3 days after his platoon on patrol drove over an improvised explosive device, figure one. Amputations and debridement were performed. Samples were taken, and clinical doses of drugs were delivered to his mouth and, later, when dehydration set in, his veins. Cultures were run in 3 separate laboratories far from the field. Studies revealed a new variety of sporulating fungus. Death calls to life, and in the empty places, the authors found these flowers, framed in slender dishes, figure two. These were assayed and identified as beauty that could not find a root in metal, and therefore yearned sunward from the place he kept his wallet, the place his savior bled, the place he waved goodbye. The pathogen was found too late for antifungal measures. The family requested palliative treatment. The isolate, a member of the order Mucorales, was named for the field where it moved from soil to flesh, figure three. Figure one, earth knows what man cannot. Figure two, flowers are better than bullets. Figure three, a roadside in Kabul.
That was actually a scientific entry, right? What made you write that poem?
I hate to go all the way back. I'll just go back as far as college when I'll say I was a pretty serious poet. After that, I drifted away. As many people do, they get into the work world and other things happen. I became a scientific copy editor for the American Society for Microbiology and sat at a table every day and read things I didn't understand and hung out with absolutely wonderful people. I did that for about 10 years until I got hooked on the idea of being a music critic. And I wandered away once I'd established some contacts in the music world. I wandered away from the editing job to be a music critic.
But why this poem of all the scientific material you read?
It was after the music critic thing and during the time I was a music critic that I found my own creativity blossoming, I guess you'd say, farther and farther as I went along. Eventually, I had to go back and get some real full-time money, and I went back to the American Society for Microbiology with the idea of earning money for a grad school to get an MFA. And it was right after I got back that I was reading a story, I was editing a story in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology that was about a case very much like the less surreal elements of this case. It was a case study of a man who'd been injured, and this fungus had gotten into the injury. And there was, even though they knew what had happened, there was nothing that could be done. It was that sense of people just waiting. And also that sense of something growing that was actually an agent of death, I think.
And then your editorial comments at the end.
Yeah, so
figure one, two, and three.
Yeah.
Just read those again.
Yeah, okay.
Figure one.
Figure one. Earth knows what man cannot. Figure two. Flowers are better than bullets. Figure three. A roadside in Kabul.
Pamela Murray Winters. In closing, I do want you to read the poem about Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested because you said you want to write about depression.
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't have it? And that's a bold notion because it's like being very courageous and exposing personal things. But it's not said because of that reason.
Mm-hmm.
People are not, and poetry. Well, let's just hear this poem and then mention it.
Yeah, confessional
Seattle.
Poetry has that reputation of just being, we're talking about our diaries. It's minimized and there's so much more that can be done. But anyway, this is a relatively new poem. It's called It's Like Seattle. I'll note that it's the last poem I remember Stanley Plumlee speaking admiringly of before he died. Just realized that. It's like Seattle. That dog down the road who howled for an hour last night is barking. They say anger is the flip side. Back to me on your side, you sleep as if I hadn't shrieked at you, cried in the parking lot, hours and years before, and will again. Do you forget? You're a warm soul who burns cool. I hold myself against myself. Kindling, they call it. It burns deeper and longer each time. Nights I run math in my head, an amateur actuary, wondering when I'll free you. I remember reasons to hate me, forget others. I play solitaire on my phone, under the covers, to stave it off. You are so peaceful, I almost think I can't hurt you. Or maybe you've stopped loving me. But I have this black dog skill. I'm so good at this. It's like Seattle. Nobody who lives there tells you the solace of gray, the beauty of the rain.
That is a beautiful poem about depression. So that if you can take a malady and transform it into beauty, I say go, girl. That was the voice of Pamela Murray Winters. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-productions by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.